Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Thank you for joining me once again. Greetings, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbouet. That word, I know you know what it means. Adriana, please give them the definition.
Quiditas, Latin, the whatness of a thing, the essential nature of something, the quality that makes a thing what it is.
Yes, absolutely correct. Quiditas is the whatness or essence of a thing or person. And in this episode, I want to talk to you about being a producer, whether that be in television or movies. You know, when you look at the credits at the end of a movie or a television show, you'll see producers and you'll see a long list of people, you know, and it seems like almost anybody can get this title. You know, many credited producers are simply financiers. Others may have been paid money, but have a connection or have performed the favor that gave him that credit. And sometimes it's an actor who may have taken some back-end money in return, you know, to take a pay cut, and they get a producer credit. But if you look closely, you'll see a little thing at the end of one or two people's names, and that's PGA. And that stands for the Producers Guild of America. Now, these are the producers who do a phenomenal job of actually getting the film made. And what I mean by that, they have the job of finding the script, polishing it, charming the financiers to back the movie. They get distributors to guarantee sales or a studio to bankroll it. They do all the paperwork. You know, they talk to the right actors, getting them to see if they want to do a project. You know, it's all the behind-the-scenes stuff. So a lot of people have written in and they've asked me, how do I become a producer? And that answer is different for everyone. It seems to me that most of these people who become producers are organized and they love organizing. You know, when I talked to some of my past guests, they were like, I'm the person who put parties together, or I was the woman who, you know, ran the beer company, or I did pharmaceutical sales. And all these people had to not only think quicker in the feet, they also had to think outside the box. And, you know, producers are likely to come from majors like economics, you know, from English departments. They have careers in finance or law. It's crazy how all these different other jobs can lead to being a producer. So there's no one way or one path. If you like organization and you like putting paperwork together and you like putting packages together, then you might be a good producer. You know, and that reminds me of a quote by Robert Rodriguez, one of my favorite directors, and that quote is this: when given an opportunity, deliver excellence and never quit. I'll say that again. When given an opportunity, deliver excellence and never quit. Isn't that great? And that reminds me of my next guest. My next guest is an absolute phenomenal producer. She is someone that really cares about what she does. And when you have her on the set, you know that she's got your back. So without any further ado, let me welcome to the show, BD. Hey, BD, how you doing?
Doing okay.
Thank you so much for joining me on the show. So, you know, as you know, the name of this show is called The Quiddituzz Factor. And so quiddituzz means the whatness or essence of a thing or person. And so I'm trying to basically figure out what makes you you. So I'm going to start at the very beginning. When you were like 8 or 9 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up? Because I don't think it was a producer. So tell me, what did you want to be?
A marine biologist. And I lived in Indiana, so I couldn't be more landlocked than anywhere else. But I wanted to be in the ocean. I wanted to be in the water. Like every time I would swim, I would like see how deep I could go and how long I could hold my breath. And I was just so intrigued with the water. And I really wanted to be a marine biologist.
Wow, so obviously things have changed since then. So how did you go from marine biologist to film producer?
So I was always into musicals or theater and music. You know, I was a singer and I was in the band, and I in college got into the orchestra. And so that was kind of what saved me, I think, during school, was all my musical and theatrically based extracurriculars. But what was funny is I was really into, at one point I did an internship at Eli Lilly, and I was into pharmacology because I loved chemistry. Like, that was also a thing for me. And I spent a summer working at Michigan State in their world of, like, I can't remember what it's called, like the ology of it, but essentially it's about making wine. Mm-hmm. And I worked with a professor there, and they had an actual like winery set up at Michigan State. And the summer after I graduated high school, my gift from my parents, my graduation gift, was a trip to Napa and Sonoma to actually go meet the vintners, the master vintners, the wineries, and actually learn like, what does it take to run a winery? Mm-hmm. And this was back in the late 90s. So of course, email was new and the internet was still kind of new. And so there, you really just had to go if you wanted to learn these things. And I wasn't old enough to drink, but that didn't stop some of the wineries from being like, here, try, because they were so excited that like an 18-year-old wanted to learn how to make wine. And of course, some of the bigger wineries were like, here's our email address, reach out. And it was just like, well, okay, but I'm here. I'd really like to talk to you. But of course, I learned that unless you inherit a winery, are, you know, extremely wealthy, or kind of already are born into it and get into that world, it's not easy to do. And it's a very difficult, very expensive world to be in. And so I kind of shifted away from that and went to college for music. I was music education with a double principal when I first started.
Interesting. So now you're in college and you're studying music. How did you make the leap from music into film and producing?
Oh, wow. There's like seven professions in the middle of that, just because mm-hmm. I've kind of lived like multiple lives in my lifetime. It's funny because when I go back to kind of my origin story as a film, growing up in the Midwest, it wasn't something that I knew that I could do. You know, if you wanted to be in media, like there was this idea of running off of the circus. You know, you could move to LA or New York and try to get famous, but we all expected you to come back in like between 2 and 5 years with your tail between your legs going, I tried, you know. But that was actors and singers, and it wasn't the more operational side of it. We didn't even know that was a possibility. So I remember watching I would intentionally wait in between the movies on HBO, because they would have the little vignettes that were the makings of, and they would show the behind the scenes and the cameras and the equipment and the people and the tents. Like, I remember seeing all of that and just being really intrigued by it. And then I remember VH1 and MTV used to do, like, VH1 had pop-up video, MTV had the behind the music, and they would show how the music videos were made and, you know, all the behind the scenes of it. I just remember just really digging into that. That was an important thing to me for a really long time. And it wasn't until I moved to California, actually, it was my junior year of college, the opportunity came up to move to California just out of the blue. And I ultimately wanted to live in the Bay Area, but it was too expensive to just pick up and go to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So I had an opportunity to move to San Diego with some people in the band that I knew that had a room in their house. And they're like, we'll hold it for you if you want to move out here. And so I left Michigan State. I moved to San Diego. I could not get into SDSU right off the bat because it was really expensive. You know, I could get in, but it was really expensive because I was out of state. So I essentially went, I signed up for band and like one other class so I could pay out of pocket for it. And that was it. And I moved in with these people. And it was about 2 months after I moved to San Diego that I met my now partner. And he's wanted to do film his whole life. Like, he's born and raised Southern California. Film has been in his world his whole life. And he's the one who told me when I first met him, he was like, well, I'm going to be a director. And I'm like, oh, that's not a real job. And, you know, he took it in stride. I mean, I honestly probably would have smacked me if I were him, but he took it in stride. He's like, well, you can believe that. That's totally up to you. But the reality of it wasn't a real job for me, because we had no idea. We did not know that there were jobs outside of actors and singers and hosts, you know, outside of like cable news network or the news side of it, the journalist side of it, the radio side of it. That's what you went to school for in the Midwest. So he was the one who actually got me into it after kind of a middle ground of sales, massage therapy, nursing school, pre-med, And then when I was working at Cedars-Sinai, about to shift pre-med, was when I decided to shift out of it completely. And then I went into film and I actually started as a makeup artist.
You know, this is really intriguing to me because, you know, I went to film school and I thought you had to go step by step by step to get the job that I wanted. So how did you go from being a makeup artist to a producer? Here's another kind of strange leap that you made.
Well, so when I back to the high school days, you know, when I was doing plays and musicals and things like that, you know, I would be having a role in the play, whether it was the lead or supporting or whatever. And I would show up, you know, 3-4 hours early, do my makeup, then do everybody else's makeup, then go on stage. And so I always had a penchant for it and I loved doing it. And I understood stage makeup and like I could age people and I could do fun creatures and things like that. So when I decided I wanted to do film makeup, I was concerned that it would be super different than stage makeup. So I took a class at Studio Makeup Academy and that was at Sunset Gower Studios. So I would work at the hospital during the day, go to makeup school at night, and then work on movies on the weekends. And the first movie I worked on, my partner kind of dragged me into. He just wanted to get me on set, on a movie set, not a short, because we've been doing like 48-hour projects and shorts and things like that. And so I go to this film set, very first one I ever worked on. And it was fun. You know, I wanted to hang with the makeup department, but I saw like they were spending good amounts of money. They had a crane and we were in Santa Barbara. They put us up for the night. They took us out to dinner and paid for everything, even though we were working for free. And I'd seen the bill for dinner that night. It was almost $1,000 for everybody because we went to a nice steak restaurant and he let us order drinks, kind of whatever we wanted. And the next day I asked him, I said, well, how much are you making this movie for? And he was like, oh, $35,000. I'm like, in steak dinners? And he's like, excuse me? And I said, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be rude. I literally saw what you spent on the dinner last night. If that's coming out of your budget, you're now that much less towards the movie. I said, how far are you into this? He goes, well, it's our first weekend. I said, okay, so you now have $34,000 to make your movie. So, you know, and I started kind of breaking it down and I was like, so how much have you spent so far? And he's like, well, I don't know. And I'm like, well, how much more do you have? And he was like, well, we're doing these weekends. Okay, well, so what happens when you run out of money? And he was like, well, I'll just find more. And I was like, that's really great, but I don't think it works that way. I'm like, do you want some help? And so I offered to run payroll, to set up his budget, to go through all of his expenses. And essentially ended up line producing the first movie I ever worked on. I did it for free because I didn't know what I was doing. I just happened to have a head for numbers and organization and all of that. And so all I wanted to do was go PA with the makeup department and ended up running all of this and learned a lot of very important lessons doing it. But it was definitely, you know, that just happened to happen that way. And of course, I went right back into makeup after that and did many years of makeup. And did a little bit of production managing and I AD'd like once or twice. I kind of tried out a bunch of different departments. As much as I enjoyed makeup and the creativity of it, I found myself always falling back into the operational side of production management, you know, line producing, you know, that side of it. And so that's kind of where that was my transition out of makeup into producing.
And for those of you listening in, I have to let you know that being a producer is not an easy job. And let me tell you, when something goes wrong on the set, who does everybody run to? The producer. It's one of the most thankless jobs on the set.
I feel like the best analogy I've ever heard is herding cats.
Yeah.
Because that's essentially what you're doing. Everything wants to go in the direction you don't want it to go, but you've got to keep everything going in the same direction. And that's really the best way to describe it, is herding cats.
That's funny, man. Wow. So tell me in the audience, what was your first big job as a producer?
Well, so the very first movie I ever did, so I just started going out there telling people that I was producing. And I tried to put a movie together with some colleagues of mine. And it was about a $5 million budget. And it was a horror movie. And of course, looking back on it now, I'm very particular about what I put out to the world and the messages I put out and the stories. And if that script landed on my desk today, I would emphatically say no. But I was young and starting out and just trying to get things done. And the people I was working with were out of Dallas, Texas. And I was just like, you know, they had like Viggo Mortensen had said yes to the project because the one producer just called him, or the director had called him and asked him to do it. And he said yes. And the director's brother somehow had an in to Mark Cuban. And it was a very controversial story. It was around like the Catholic Church and their abuse of children. Like I said, not something I would ever do today, but it was a horror movie based around this. Think like Jason and that whole craziness. And Mark Cuban actually said yes. And he put $5 million in escrow and he had his stipulations that had to be matched. And I remember going to Thanksgiving that year and telling a family member of mine that I was doing this movie and that we'd raised $5 million. And he's been in the industry for, you know, 20, 30 years. And I remember he turned to me and he was like, who would give you $5 million? And it wasn't a mean thing. It was just, he came from the studio world and he just didn't understand in the little indie world why somebody would just hand off money to somebody to make a movie. What was funny though, is there was a meeting that happened with Mark and I was told about it too last minute. So I couldn't get to Dallas to go to the meeting. And the brother literally walked into Mark Cuban's office and was like, so this is how it's going to be. And like tried to lay out all the steps. And Mark just kind of, from what I understand, what I was told, Mark just kind of sat there, nodded his head. You know, they finished the meeting, they left, and the money was gone. Like, not even an hour later, the money was gone out of escrow, which doesn't surprise me. Like, you don't walk into Mark Cuban's office and tell him how it works. So that was kind of my first experience in that. And I'm glad that it didn't work out the way that it was going to, A, just because of the content of the movie. It was not something I would necessarily want my name on today. And B, it was just, we weren't ready. Like none of us were ready. We were not at that point to pick up a movie of that size. So then again, and going out and just telling people I was producing, I was building budgets and doing schedules and kind of more the line producing side of it. But then I got a call from a contact who had his own money and he was trying to get his movie made. And it was this little drama. And it was a great story. I actually really enjoyed the story itself. And he had $20,000. And so he's like, let's make this movie. And okay, so we made a $20,000 movie. We made it in 2 weeks. We paid everybody. We had insurance. We had catering. We had Crafty. I mean, we had a crew of like 15 people because that's all we could afford to pay everybody. And I'm sure we sadly broke many labor laws, but we didn't know what we didn't know at the time. And of course, this was back in 2010 when, you know, yes, Film LA was, you know, you have to have permits, but they weren't as militant as they are now. And so we figured out how to make it work and we didn't get in trouble and we finished it. And the trailer is actually still out on YouTube. I don't think the movie ever came out, but the trailer is out on YouTube. We still shot to LAX. Like we did things that now as an established producer, I look back on and I'm just like, oh my gosh, we broke so many laws that we all should have gone to jail and we didn't, but we should have, you know, and it's you just don't know what you don't know when you're first starting out. And that's how we got it done. And then that one kind of faltered a little bit because the man who financed it was very set on it getting a wide theatrical release. And the reality of it is that was never going to happen. There were no known names. It was a drama. Back in the day, it was considered ethnic, which was just not, that just didn't, that had a hard time selling to begin with back then, much less a drama with no names. Like it was just, it was everything against that movie to ever have it get any type of wide theatrical, much less limited theatrical. You know, it was a shot in the dark to begin with, which is sad. I'm glad it's not like that anymore. But you know, back then it was very much the case. And then I went on to my next movie, which was twice the budget. We were $45,000, shot for 2 weeks. Same thing. You know, we paid everybody. We had catering. We had Crafty. We had insurance. We still didn't have permits, but we were all in one location, completely contained indoors. And again, Film LA doesn't love that, but we made it work. And that one actually did end up getting out. And that's actually how I've met a lot of my East Coast friends because it did make the festival circuit. That one was called Birds of a Feather. I think it's still out on iTunes if you want to take a look at it. Oh, wow. And we had a lot of cameos. We had Olympia Dukakis and Trevor Donovan and Bruce Blanche. And they were friends of our director that they just showed up and did a day here or there on the movie. And it was just really fun. It was a absurd comedy. You know, the actors all went to our director's acting school and everybody was really just kind of team get it done because they loved our director and, you know, they really wanted to support him. And it just was one of those projects that had a wonderful heart and it just continued to grow from there. And it was, I'm happy when I still see it out there because it's such a tiny movie that we put together 12 years ago.
Wow. Time flies, man. I can't believe that. It reminds me of a film I worked on about 12 years ago. It was a budget, I would say over, I'm not going to give the exact number, but it was over $30,000, let's say. And I ended up having to buy a short-term policy to cover the film with insurance. But the director had wasted money on other stuff that we shouldn't have spent money on. So can you explain to me and the audience a little bit about short-term policies and the caliber of films when you're working with a low budget like that?
It's funny because I go back to the days of when I did really tiny movies like that, and I think about some of the policies that I bound. And granted, they were all short-term policies, because when you're doing a movie that's small, you're not buying a policy for the year. You can't afford that. So you're buying, 30 days. I think the shortest term you can get is 30 days.
30 days.
And so we were buying 30-day policies for $1,500, $1,200, $1,800, which on a $20,000 movie, that's almost 20% of your budget. So you definitely, that's very high in comparison to what everything else is. But if you don't need more than that, and you're literally just covering rentals and liability and things like that, it's the best thing you can do. I had a movie this last year. I remotely produced a movie in Chicago, and it was not a tiny budget. It was over $1 million, but it was still pretty small. And they came back with their insurance quote, and it was super small. And I'm like, I don't understand how this is so low. This, because it was a lot of underwater work, and there was a lot of, like, we're putting equipment in the water. And I was like, no, this should be three times the cost. But because in my world now, I bind policies for the entire year so that we're covered prep, shoot, and post. That way, if something happens to the footage or something happens to any of the equipment or anything in the post side, we're still covered. And then I realized when they sent me the policy, I'm like, oh, you're getting a short-term policy. Okay. And it was just this fun little throwback of, like, had forgotten that they even existed. Because once you hit a certain point, I think, in your producing, I now understand why producers that do big budget stuff have a hard time stepping back or even understanding these micro budget movies. Because if you never did it, you don't know it's possible. And even if you did do it, you're so far out of it that you almost have to, like, reteach or relearn these steps that you did to try to save money. And so, yeah, I would share with people all the time, you can get a short-term policy. You just have to read your policy very carefully to make sure you're not being taken advantage of, to where if you do have a claim and you do need to get something covered, they don't kick it back and say, oh, actually, that's not covered, because you really didn't read the fine print of your policy. So there are some little tidbits there as a young indie producer. Don't learn that the hard way, because that's a hard one to learn the hard way.
So I'm a small indie director. I make micro budget films. Can you tell me in the audience, what was the first big film that you worked on, that was just, like, huge, that, so far away from the independent world that you really felt like, yes, I made it. It's like the dream that I guess we're all aspiring to.
I mean, so the question is, what do you consider big?
I mean, anything, I guess, over $5 million with a big crew that's got, like, 45 people or more, and that they have shooting days of over, 15 days, maybe 20, 30 days, something like that.
I mean, $5 to $6 million budget, you're still dealing, like, your crew is still about 60 people. Like, you're not 25 people at that size budget. Like, I the last time I did 25 people was, I think, 100,000 or 200,000. I kept it pretty small and lean. But even, like, when you start getting into 5 and 6 million, now you're in union world, tier one IATSE union world, and they just won't let you do a crew that small. So you're essentially living in the, like, you can maybe go as small as 45, and that's really pushing it. I know IATSE will hate that I just said that. But you're typically living in about 55 to 65 people pretty regularly. And so I would say, so I did work on a big union show back when I was doing makeup, because we moved to Louisiana for a little while, and I got to work on Jumper, like 20th Century Fox Jumper.
Oh, wow.
And I remember, like, being on set, huge trailer park, so much money just wasted. Like, I found myself just looking around, and this is even before I started producing, but I found myself looking around set, seeing all of these people just standing around doing nothing, and all of this stuff just not being used. And it just seemed like a huge waste to me. And it kind of opened my eyes going into producing about, yes, there's a time and place for everything. And yeah, there's a reason you have this stuff on standby, but it still didn't make sense. Like, I still saw a ton of waste on that. So I will say, if you want me to share stories, I probably shouldn't give names. People who know me will probably figure out what these are, but I probably shouldn't give names if I want to share stories. I would have to say I've had a couple movies and not through my own doing, I will say, that started at a lower budget that ended up closer to that outside of my purview, where I'm out there yelling, no, 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 because, you know, it's going over budget and I'm trying to help keep it to the number I was told to keep it at. But the people above me are just spending and approving and, you know, well, it's our money, we'll figure it out. And then we get to the end and they come back yelling at me going, I don't understand why it's so over budget. And I just stand there and I'm like, well, look at all the emails and text messages and everything else where I said, this is over budget, this is over budget. Just, you know, tried to fix it. But there, you know, when I've started on those, like I've had a few where I've started out on that. And actually nowadays that's kind of what I'm doing. Like it's, I do step back sometimes in the 1 to 3 world, but I'm living pretty regularly 5 million and up now. And it's funny because I now understand. So when I first started, I was doing 100,000 and 200,000 and $300,000 movies. Like you and I met on the, Almost Paris that we shot out on Long Island. And that was a micro budget movie. And I remember hearing about Black Swan because that came out around the same time. And they're like, we were an $11 million movie. We were so low budget. And the actor gave up her trailer so we could afford this. And I'm just like, really? Seriously? And it didn't make sense to me why that was low budget. But now because I'm now in that world regularly, like I just came off an $11 million project. I have a $10 million project that's in worlds of financing and kind of final steps right now. And I have a $20 million that was just dropped on my desk. So I very much understand the low budget $10 million movie. And I did air quotes. I know your listeners can't see my air quotes, but I did the low budget air quote $10 million movie. And essentially what it is you're doing a $15 to $20 million movie for $10 million. And so it actually does become low budget in that term, because once you start getting up into those numbers, you know, the amount it costs to make a movie now outside of the points that are your outliers, stunts, effects, locations, like obviously if you're going to be in a huge stadium or the Statue of Liberty, you're paying a whole lot more to be there than you are to be in a cornfield in Oklahoma. But all that being said, like those are your outliers that can expand or contract your budget. But the idea of what you need to actually make a movie isn't really that different from movie to movie. Like the more of those outliers you have, the bigger the crew you need. But then again, it contracts once you don't need that anymore. And so you kind of have this idea of what it costs. Your costs that shift, you know, your above the line talent, directors, writers, producers, producers not on my movies, producers on other movies. And then of course, location, stunts, those types of things. Those are the things that really kind of eat the larger parts of your budget. And if you have a movie where your below the line cost is $3 million, but you're making the movie for 10. So that means you've got $7 million going into these above the line costs or into these variable costs, which costs a lot more. And now you only have $3 million to actually make the movie. That's your crew, your catering, your rentals, your permits, your insurance, like that, your lawyers, like that all fits in that $3 million. That gets eaten up really fast, yeah. You know, and that goes away, especially when you get people at union rates and you've got, you know, union fringes on top of that, plus payroll fringes and everything else. It gets eaten up really fast. And that $7 million is not always variable. Like I'm just giving this example on a $10 million movie, obviously to show, but that $7 million is not always variable because let's say half of that is going to a named cast person that's selling your movie that has the sales slip for $8 to $10 million and literally is guaranteeing your investors their money back. That person can't go away and their salary is not going to drop down. Nor is there support around them. Like if you have somebody that comes with a private jet and all their assistants and hair and their makeup and everything else, their rates are already set. That dollar figure set, that's not ever changing. And so those are the things that I think a lot of crew don't completely understand. And that's where I get a little frustrated sometimes. And believe me, on my movies that I put together, I have kind of in my brain and kind of in my ethical world, I have my caps on things because I don't appreciate ever being part of a crew where you have a talent that's getting millions of dollars and the rest of us, you know, are getting a whole lot less than that and expected to break our backs to make sure that person is accommodated. When I'm like, you're making enough that you could have a small army to accommodate you. I don't necessarily need my crew to be doing that. And I know there are people who won't like that I say that, but That is the frustration. I think that's a little bit of the reality we have in our industry. And I think that's some of what we're trying to change. Because I know I'm kind of in this world of change makers that want things to be more equitable, that want things to be more fair, and that want to have kind of this world where, yes, we're an art, and yes, we'll have a level of suffering for our art, but not to the detriment of ourselves and the benefit of others. I think there needs to be kind of, if you're going to suffer, then we all equally suffer. And if you're going to succeed, then we all equally succeed. Not in a utilitarian sort of way, egalitarian sort of way. Sorry, I said that wrong. But in a way that is more fair than what currently exists. So if you look at my movies that I have coming up that I'm producing, that's more the structure that I have laid out. Like, I make sure everybody gets a living wage. I make sure everybody's paid. You know, when I'm talking about me as the lead producer, not me as the production manager or the line producer under other people, you know, having them dictate what I can and can't do. Because I know some people think those are my movies, and I take a lot of ownership and pride in what I do. So yes, I call them my movies, but I have people I have to answer to. So they are my movies to a point, but I can't control everything. So I just wanted to specify that, because some people have come to me before and said, but that was your movie. And I'm like, no, I was the line producer. That was my set. That wasn't my movie. It's a very different world.
And that's why I'll never produce another film again. Because, you know, it's crazy because, you know, you're right. People don't understand where the money goes. And so I was working with this one guy, and he spent half the budget on trying to get a name actor that was supposed to sell a film. And guess what? 5-6 years later, the film sold, but it didn't make any money. And people are still calling me up looking for their money, which I don't have. And I feel really bad. So I completely understand where you're coming from in the strange, strange world of producing, which I'll let someone else that's more experienced do than myself.
This is where I get frustrated with unions, because there's money sitting in a performance bond and everybody else has been paid, and there's plenty of money in that performance bond to pay that background. And we have been working for 2 years to try to get that done. And I feel like every time I turn around, like, so can we do it now? Can we do it now? Can we please pay these people? Like, it's not that much money. Like, they're maybe getting a couple $100 each, but it's money they're owed, and they've been owed it for 2 years. And because they're under a collective bargaining agreement with SAG, and everything's with SAG, it has been this whole time, it just keeps getting held up because COVID and delays, and, you know, they're not big about parting with their bonds. And it's just, you know, always something. And it's frustrating, because I don't ever want people to not get paid. Like, that is, I have paid people out of my own pocket before to make sure that they get paid. And then I go chasing down the production company to make sure that things get paid. But I will say, like, for vendors, I have learned that there's a hierarchy. And I don't know if I should be putting this out publicly, but there is definitely a hierarchy in getting companies, vendors paid. Because when you look at, like, mom and pops and companies that can't shoulder that loss, like, they put money out to make something happen. Caterers, you know, local clothing companies, things that are not big corporate entities, they can't shoulder a loss like that. So we don't want businesses, we don't ever want to be responsible for businesses closing. Right. So we want to make sure those are paid. You know, obviously crew comes up very high, cast comes up very high, like things like that, where you want to make sure, especially people that are scale rates, they need to get paid because they're not making a ton of money. And then they kind of come up higher up. And then sadly, you know, I hate to say background kind of jumps to the bottom, but it is one of the smaller amounts, and it would make sense to get it out faster, but it is also something where when you know you have a bond that can pick it up, you know, now it kind of falls back into the world of the union of saying, hey, please help us. You know, this is where we are. And like that one vendor that we have that's still outstanding, every month I go back to the team and I'm like, so can we pay them? And that's me, what I have a responsibility of doing, but yet I'm still the face to the vendor saying, I'm sorry, we haven't paid you yet. You know, and it's affected my relationship with them because they're a vendor that I use on other movies, and I've had to kind of step back using them because I don't want to be positioned for that to ever happen again. Because if it happens once, it's a mistake. If it happens twice, it's a pattern. And I don't ever want to have that pattern with anybody. So I've held back using that vendor, but I hate losing them because I was using them all the time. And it definitely was a world of, you know, I'm consistently tracking down, like, this is now, even though I have been off of this movie for over 2 years now, 2021, almost 3 years, is going on off this movie, I am still working unpaid, you know, tracking down these people to make sure that they get paid and make sure that these things get squared away. And it's just, I don't know, I think there's an ethics that comes with being a good producer, and there's a lot of unethical producers out there. And I think it's our responsibility as ethical producers to weed out the unethical producers, and to, like, I'll warn my friends who are crew against unethical producers. And I'll warn people of, like, hey, this has been my experience. You know, I've worked with some really interesting people. I don't want to go too far into that. I've worked with some very interesting people in my life and in my career, but they've always paid their bills. And there's kind of varying levels of what you can tolerate. And, you know, people who are not the nicest people, if they pay their bills, you know, if you're okay with being abused for a little while, you know, because you're getting paid, that's its own level of abusive relationship we deal with in this industry. And there's a whole world of therapists out there to help us with that. But you're getting paid, you're doing a job, you know what you're getting into. But when those same abusive people maybe stop paying their bills or don't pay their bills, or other people don't pay their bills, like, that's kind of a cardinal sin that we have, where it's just like, you know, that does need to happen. And so it's, I don't know, it's frustrating and it's difficult. And I will also say there are moments that it's just an accident. Like, I just came off a show with where it was leading into the holidays and everything closed down really fast. And I'm getting emails from people going, hey, I didn't get paid. And I'm like, oh my God, how did you not get paid? And so, of course, we're moving, you know, as quick as we can to try to get them paid. And it's those types of things. And again, I'm not on that project anymore. I'm not being paid, but I'm staying aboard in my own way to make sure to follow through, to make sure these things happen. So it's, I don't know, it's, I hear what you say about some people are cut out for it, some people aren't. And it's, I know people who don't take it personally and who don't take it into this world of, I must make sure this happens. And maybe that's what sets me apart from other people, but it's, I don't know, it's just something I've always done. And I feel like if I'm going to make it, if I'm going to make change in this industry, then I have to be at that level to affect change. Otherwise, I'm just sitting behind going, why won't it change? And yet not, you know, doing anything to fix it.
So, you know, I have to ask you this question, BD, and especially now with everything that's going on in the world, how does an independent filmmaker raise money for the film? Where do you find money? That is the golden question.
Oh my God, it's like the worst time ever to start out in film. It's so hard right now, not just the money side of it, but like COVID has just as it's wiped out a lot of other, you know, companies and really had a hard time on certain industries. COVID has hit us really hard. And I would think to try to get into this industry right now, I don't know, it could be a double-edged sword in the sense that it's very difficult on one side and it makes it easier on the other side because you don't know what you're missing. You know, if you come in now, you've got to wear masks, you've got to social distance, you've got to test every other day. Like, you go through, that's your norm. Like, you've just always known it that way and you don't know it any differently. So there's no mourning something that you never knew that you had. But the rest of us who didn't start with that, who have, you know, been on these film sets for 10, 15, 20 years, and, you know, the camaraderie and the, you know, the falling asleep on each other's shoulders at the 14th hour and, like, you know, all the things that we do where you kind of get this family, you know, feeling in this group of people, and we're literally being forced apart because of COVID, I think is that much harder. And it's, I know a lot of people who've just left, who are just like, I'm done. They have no interest in continuing in the world of COVID right now. But as far as finding money right now, I mean, look, I have my own mantras of money is plentiful, money is everywhere, there is enough for everyone. Yes, there are money hoarders out there that we call billionaires, but there are definitely, there's enough out there. I mean, hell, our country still continues to print money every day. So obviously there's enough out there. If there's not enough, they print more. But it is definitely the world of understanding. Like, I have had an easier time of finding money by learning finance and being able to speak in that language and speak and understand that terminology and have those conversations, when before I was just like, would you like to invest in my movie? And it was just very, you know, earnest and innocent and somewhat naive. I feel like it's, you know, understanding the finance side of it and really kind of digging further into that has made a much better, much easier approach to money people doing that. So I would say if you want to get into it now, the best thing you could do is go take a finance class and learn all about investing, learn about SEC laws, learn about, you know, blue sky laws, learn about all the things that you need to know that you don't ever want to get caught not knowing, because those are the things you go to jail for. And I feel like they're getting less forgiving, because saying you just didn't know isn't a defense anymore. Like, you can't walk into court and say, well, I just didn't know. It's not a defense anymore. They essentially, the information is out there for you to learn, and there's a place for you to learn it from. So you can't claim ignorance anymore. So you really need to go dig in, learn about corporation formation, learn about taxation, learn about investments, learn about SEC. Like, there's all these things that, as a producer, you have to know this stuff. And if you don't know this stuff, then you're a creative producer. So put that in front of your title. You know, if you don't want to go learn how to create a company, how to read a contract, how to deal with, you know, risk mitigation, you know, all these things I've mentioned in the last couple of minutes, then put the word creative in front of your producer title. And I'm not downing creative producers, because I know a lot of excellent, freaking excellent, you know, business producers that are also creative producers. So I'm not diminishing them at all. But if you truly don't want the business side of it and don't want anything to do with the business side of it, I feel like creative producer is the way that you do that, where you can focus on the story, you can work with the writers, you can work with the director, you can work with the actors, you can be more involved on the creative side of it, and then hire a producer or partner with a producer that does that more business oriented, you know, finance part of it. Because if you don't know how to do that and you try to push your way through, kind of like you've been sharing stories, Michael, of mistakes that have been made and bridges that have been burned and things like that, when you're at $50,000, you're not going to go to jail for that. When you're at $5 million, that's a big deal. And people do go to jail for that. So you've got it. You definitely have to know your way around.
Well, BD, thank you so much for sharing that advice with us. For those of you listening, definitely write that down. Go back and listen to this podcast again, because that's great advice. So, BD, now we're at the part of the show where I like to ask my in-depth questions. And so my first question to you is this. You know, before, at the beginning of the show, I told you that quiditas means the whatness or essence of a thing or person. But to make it easier on you, let's say that quiditas means magic, power, or superpower. What would your magic or superpower be? BD, what is your quiditas?
I have been told my superpower is my ability to make friends everywhere I go, and my ability to just kind of bring everybody together and keep them like together in very difficult circumstances and scenarios. And that's just, and also kind of this whole Midwest, you know, wide-eyed naivete, like not that I am naive, but it's just this, well, why not? You know, I always have that question. Well, why not? And it's, why can't we do that? Why isn't that possible? As everybody looks at me and goes, no, you can't do that. I'm like, but why not? Yeah, we could. Let's try it. Like, let's find another way. If they say no this way, then why don't we go that way? And it's, I think those are kind of a combination of those things together are my superpower.
Yes, I would have to agree with that. You do have a kind of a magical way of seeing the world. Here's another question for you. What's something that people seem to misunderstand about you?
Oh, man. I would say the big thing I get is, because I'm very outspoken and because I very much speak outspoken, but then I speak my mind to that next level. I sometimes come across as brash or pushy, or people think that they're not going to like me, or that they think that I'm not going to like them. And I have actually had a few people that have come at me in a very kind of hostile manner because of that. It's just a misinterpretation of my energy and excitedness of let's get it done, you know, but it's so overpowering to them. Sometimes I think people take it as I'm pushy and obnoxious and not going to listen. And that's, I don't know if you've heard in this, like, yes, I have my opinions on things, but I'm never giving an opinion to down a group or to create a box or anything. Because if anything, I'm all about breaking down walls and getting out of boxes and not being kind of confined in that world. But I do think there are some norms that exist that we have to acknowledge that they are there, and then, you know, figure out a way to redefine it. And so it's, I think for people who don't know me well, that is a that's something that happens. I feel like it happens less the older I get, and maybe that's a maturity thing that I'm better at, like, kind of pre-qualifying myself with people. But when I was younger, it happened all the time.
Tell me about somebody who touched your heart and how they changed your life for the better.
I mean, I've had some really excellent mentors in my career, in my lifetime. And I remember a time when I didn't have any mentors and I was kind of flailing in the dark and trying to read every book I could find and you know, absorb every bit of information I could get. I would say the most important person is my partner. He really, and like I said, I've said some horrible things over the years to him, and he had every reason to just be like, bye, and just, you know, take off. And he never did. And he's always been super supportive. And he's always been standing behind me in the term of like, you are a, like, and I'm not saying this to for myself. I'm saying this is what he's been saying to me is, you know, you are an excellent producer. You are a knowledgeable producer. You know, you can run circles around these people. And he's been saying that for 10 years. And I've been spending probably 8 or 9 of those years being like, you have to say that, you know, and not believing him and really just kind of, you know, I think making it more difficult when he's like his whole reason. It feels sometimes like his reason for being there is to really just push me and support me and show me that I could be better and that I could be bigger and that I have what I need and that I don't need to wait for somebody else. And it's sad that it's taken me 12 years to figure that out, but you know, it is definitely, I mean, he was the one who sat down with, you know, 48 Laws of Power and would like pull up a chapter in 48 Laws of Power and have me read it and be like, okay, so give me a scenario that you've been through that's just like this. You know, and then how should you have handled it versus how you did? Or, you know, you're going through and reading The Alchemist and like introducing me to things that I think caused me to step back, calm down, quiet down, listen way more than I talked. Like my dad, when I was a kid, always used to say, you have two ears and one mouth. You should listen twice as much as you talk. And I couldn't do that. I had a really hard time doing that when I was young. And even like now, if I get nervous, I talk a lot and sometimes get going and it's hard to quiet me down. But I definitely have learned to recognize it in myself when it's happening and I stop and I take a breath and I find a place to very graciously stop talking and then step out of it. But that's been because of him. Like he's really worked with me and caught those moments and taught me that. And it's, I think that of all the people in my life, you know, I'm most grateful and most blessed and, you know, where I am today because of my partner. And I couldn't, like, I feel like when I win my Oscar, like he is my number one thank. He is my number, you know, my very last thank. Like he will be that person that for up until the day I die, I will be like, I am here because of him.
I love the fact that you said when.
Hey, it's all about how you use your dialogue. When I win, you know, when I'm a millionaire, it's always when.
So here's another question for you. What's the one thing producing did for you that you didn't expect?
Variety, I guess, would be the best word because I quite literally have every project I do is different. Every project I do has different people, different obstacles, different needs, you know, different locations. Like you, because the thought of going to the same office every day, doing the same job in and out, makes me have a panic attack. Like I literally at one point thought about going back into the corporate world and like really like I could do it. And it was just like this vice, like this tightened and tightened and tightened on my chest. And I was like, I can't breathe. And it was, and I didn't realize like how important that was to me and until I didn't have it or until it was taken away in some way. And it was, you know, that variety is probably one of the most important things because to sit down, brainstorm, come up with problems, whether it's on the fly because we're in the thick of it and we have to move and we need a solution now because we're losing money every minute we're waiting, or it's ahead of time of let's talk about all the ways this could go wrong. You know, not that we're planning, not that we're expecting it. We plan for it, we don't expect it. You know, what are all the ways this could go wrong? We have at least a plan for everything we know about, and then we expect everything to go perfectly. But just in case it doesn't, we have these 8 plans, you know, of all these different things that we thought of. And of course, the one time it goes wrong, it's the one thing you didn't think of. But, you know, that's what keeps you on your toes. It's what keeps you young. It keeps your brain moving. you know, it's these things, and that's my favorite part of producing.
If you could turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell her?
Wow, so many things. I was pretty hot when I was 18, and I really didn't think so. Like, I look at pictures now, and I was thin, and I was cute. And I didn't think so. I was still this gawky, awkward geek that nobody liked. And yet I come across people I went to high school with that talk about how popular I was and like all these things that I didn't see that. I didn't know that. And maybe it's good that I didn't know that, because I think when you do know that as a teenager, you're a jerk. And so I'm glad I didn't know that, but I wouldn't necessarily tell myself going back. It's just, I always think about that sometimes, like one of my goal pictures that I keep up of like where I want to be size wise is when I was 18, which I'll never, ever get to ever, but I'm just like, I was, see, and then, you know, it's what I shoot for. But no, if I could go back when I was 18, I would probably tell myself to be less close-minded, because I feel like I had a lot of very specific ideas, and I don't even want to call them goals. It was just like, it was this, like, I had to hit this point, and I had to hit this point, and I had to hit this point. And there was no deviating from that. And I think that's why college was so difficult for me in the first couple of years, because nothing went the way I wanted it to. Everything kind of fell apart. And I went through a phase where about six people very close to me all died tragically. And it really, I didn't know what to do, because I had everything planned out, and everything was going to hit these you know, points in my life. And then I knew what the next point was past that. Like, I had been so planned and set, laid everything out, that when that didn't happen, I spun out, and I didn't know how to recover from it. And I think that was the moment where I learned that you can't control everything, and that you have to trust that things are happening for you, not to you. And so when something goes wrong, there's a lesson to be learned there. Cause you know, when you lose, don't lose the lesson. So if you could figure out what the lesson is, sometimes it's fast, sometimes it takes a while, you know, but if you can figure out what that lesson was, then that moment of loss wasn't lost on you, I guess is the way to put it. So I would love to go back to myself at 18 and explain that. Now, I probably wouldn't listen, because I was hard-headed, and I have a teenager, and I'm going through it right now with him. And I'm like, okay, I now know why my parents were freaking out, because I was that hard-headed teenager that wouldn't listen to my parents, that knew better than everyone else, that was very particular and specific and had it a very specific way. And I would not have listened, but I wish that I could go back and say, you know, it's not a bad thing when things don't go the way you want them to. And it's not the end of the world if you don't get that thing that you're shooting for.
Yeah, you know, you're right. You know, I will admit this. I'm a pretty big Tony Robbins fan. And one of my favorite quotes by him is, your past does not equal your future. So I look at each day as a new beginning, and I'm just going to keep trying until I make it, until I succeed at what I want to do.
Well, I think there's a part of it too. One of my self-development mentors that I listen to pretty regularly, you know, there's something that he says about ask better questions, you know, because when you get into the world of like, why isn't this happening for me? Why am I not getting, you know, why am I not further along? Why am I not here? Why am I not taking these meetings that other people are taking? And all it does, like, your brain is this wonderful machine that will start to give you an answer, whether it's right or not. Like, your brain wants to figure that out, and it starts to like come up with all these things. And typically, if you're asking that type of question, it's not going to be a positive thing that your brain's going to come up with. It's going to be like, well, you know, and it's going to be whatever reason, whether about having kids or getting married or moving away or, you know, all these things that were important for other aspects of what you did, you know, and you wouldn't be where you are without them, but your brain is looking for an answer to a question you ask. And so one of the things that he always says is ask better questions. So, you know, it's more of the world of how can I use this to take the next steps? You know, I had those moments a few years ago. I want to say it was like 2018, 2019. I've been going to Sundance a few years. I haven't yet had a movie in Sundance, it's like a goal of mine to have a movie in Sundance, to actually go to the festival with a movie versus just going to network. And I found myself really kind of getting down. This was right before Harvey Weinstein. That gives you the time frame of this. So I had found myself getting really down on the fact of like, I'm not taking the right meetings. I'm not meeting the right people. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. What is wrong with me? Why am I not further along? And of course I found myself like buried in social media, looking at other people who I consider to be my peers that were taking bigger steps than me. And it really was hurting me in a big way. And I was really beating up on myself. And I just kind of stopped and I took a breath. I said, no, hang on a second. Because this was, again, 2018, 2017, 2019, somewhere in that world. I can't remember when the whole Harvey Weinstein thing blew up. It was right before that. Mm-hmm. So I found myself not only like looking back, like if I were to take myself back to 2010, when I first started producing. And I remember I had a friend that used to go to Sundance every year, and he doesn't go anymore, but he used to drive to Sundance, and he would fill the back of his truck with alcohol and drive to Sundance, because in Utah, all alcohol is highly regulated. So you have to go to a state run liquor store. It's all super regulated. It's really hard to get alcohol in Utah. And so he would fill the back of his truck and then sell out of the back of his truck illegally, but made a ton of money doing it. And that's one of the things he did at Sundance, which, you know, again, I will never say names. I will never say who, but this was one of the things he did. And he would go and he would volunteer and he would spend time and hear these stories and the people he hung out with. And I'm like, I would give anything to go to Sundance. I will, you know, give gas money. I will sleep on a floor, like whatever I have to do. Like I would have done it to go to Sundance at that point. And now I go every year. You know, now I'm running a house at Sundance for, you know, people to stay in. And it's taken me 5-6 years to get to that point. You know, I'm so much further along. And like, if I could be where I am now, looking back to 2010 and go, oh my God, you know, I would give my left arm to be where I am now. And I think sometimes that perspective is important, that you step back, you take stock for everything you do have and all the connections you do have. And then you kind of go, okay, so how does this help me? How does this benefit me? How do I take the next step with this? And then you ask better questions in taking those next steps. So I think that's a big part of it. Cause I hear you. I empathize with you. I totally know, cause I've been in those moments, but it's a matter of the perspective of going back and maybe starting out at the very beginning and putting yourself in the shoes of where you were when you very first started out. And also, you know, there's that phrase of a high tide raises all ships. So when your colleagues and your friends are getting these opportunities and these moments of, you know, stardom and fame and access that you don't have, I'm not saying ride their coattails, because I don't think that's the right way to do it. But if they really are your friends, they want to see you come up too. And so there are ways to utilize that. Like I have a plan of when, you know, when this movie that I'm working on right now gets fully financed, you know, I know for me, it's kind of that tipping point of the roller coaster because I'm like right at the top of the roller coaster waiting for that last little push that takes you down. And then the momentum just keeps you going. I know I'm so close. I'm like right there. But I also know that eventually that roller coaster needs a push and it can't keep going on its own the whole time. And I think some people get caught up in the momentum and they're like, well, I don't know why this didn't go on forever. And it's like, well, you got to keep it going. You can't just trust it to run itself. It's not a self-perpetuating motion machine. You've got to keep it going. But it's always that moment of taking stock. You know, had I been taking those meetings prior to the whole Harvey Weinstein thing, who knows what room I would have ended up in or what situation I would have been in. And I've been very blessed and very lucky in my lifetime. And maybe it's because I am that outspoken woman that'll kick the shit out of you if you're doing to me. Like it's people, I think people are scared of me a little bit, but I've been very blessed and very lucky to have, you know, the only experiences I could even talk about in the Me Too were from like high school. And even then they weren't horrible. It was just, you know, stupid teenage boys that probably didn't know any better. But again, I think it's, I'm very grateful for that. And I think there's a reason I wasn't in those rooms, even though I was beating up on myself of why am I not meeting with the Harveys? Why am I not meeting with these people? Why am I not in these rooms? Maybe there was a bigger reason that like my guides, my, you know, the people who are above me looking out for me, whatever it is, you know, was saying, not yet. You know, yeah. Let's clear out the filth. Let's clear out the dust bunnies. And then we're going to put you in those rooms because we don't even want to put you in that environment to have to make that choice. Yeah. And I'm very grateful for that. So I recognize it and I say, okay, I'm happy. You know, that's started to happen and it's coming out more often and that's happening a lot less. You know, we're hearing it still happens, but it's happening a lot less. And we're seeing this world that's kind of recreated itself in the sense of we don't treat women that way and we don't do it that way. And it's, you know, we expect women to have more of a voice. And it just, I don't know, I feel like it's opened up more opportunities to be able to do that, but that had to happen first.
You know, that's so true. You know, I think we have a bad tendency to put ourselves down. And I don't know who said this, but someone said somewhere that misery loves company. And I don't think that we necessarily want to be miserable, but I think that people sympathize with others and that, you know, when you're feeling bad, someone else might be feel bad and you can share that situation. So here's a question for you. What's something you think you failed at?
That's a wonderful question. And I don't know. I don't ever focus on those types of things. So it's hard for me to pinpoint something, I guess. I mean, I have my moments of with my family because I'm so career oriented that sometimes I feel like I have not put enough focus to my family or put enough focus to my kid or, you know, because it's this industry is all about persistence and you just have to keep going and you have to keep working. And it's, you know, and everybody says they understand, but I have these moments where I'm just like, I'm failing. I'm failing as a wife. I'm failing as a parent. And I know I'm not like, I have a wonderful relationship. I have a wonderful child, but this is one of those things that I do beat up on myself about because career is so high up on my list of priorities that sometimes everything else gets bounced down. And I think it's the one thing I actually kind of beat up on myself about. So, I mean, I know that was super personal, but I feel like that's kind of the one area that I'm constantly trying to work on and, you know, feel like I'm thinking about, you know, even when I'm traveling, I'm thinking about like, did I check in today? How is everybody doing? Is everybody okay? And I didn't used to do that. And that was maybe where I realized I think COVID really helped me understand that better because prior to COVID, because I left in October for a job and I was gone from October till Christmas. But prior to October, it was the longest I'd been home since 2014. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was starting to get agoraphobic and not wanting to be around people because, you know, nobody wanted to catch COVID. But also I got to be a homebody and I enjoyed being around my family and I enjoyed being a part of that. And I feel like I had missed a bunch of that from, you know, 2014 on. And it was when I left and I found myself starting to fall back into old habits, it took a bit. Like October, I was fine. Most of November, I was fine. But December, I started falling back into old habits and I stopped calling and I stopped checking in and I kind of went back to where I used to be. And even my family was just like, where are you and what are you doing? And why aren't we hearing from you? Because I had been very good about checking in and how's everybody doing and being involved. And even though I was working, I was still a part of it and it fell back. And it had that much more of an effect that I realized how damaging that can be and how difficult that is for everybody. And I started to feel horrible about the years that I did that and just kind of blew it off that everybody was being overly sensitive. So I think that's, I don't feel like failure is the right word for it. Cause I don't feel like I failed, but I feel like it's one of those places that I'm constantly working on. And I definitely have not mastered. Maybe that's the better way to say it is what haven't you mastered? Like that's definitely an area that I'm constantly working on and trying to get closer to that level of mastery.
Finish this sentence for me. I believe.
I believe people are inherently good and want to help.
Finish this next sentence for me. I am most proud of.
I am most proud of women in this industry and, you know, using their voices and being out there and just really making it happen. And I am going to be very proud, I can see already, of this year because the year of the tiger, there are so many of us that are angry now. Like we were okay in 2020. We were, you know, fired up in 2021 and now we're angry. And so, you know, get a bunch of very powerful women angry and let's see what happens.
And my final question for the day is this. What does the future hold for BD Gunnell?
Oh, wonderful things. This is, like I said, I feel like I'm on the precipice of some big stuff really going this year. And I feel like I want to take my greatness and just bring everybody else with me. Like it's important to me. Again, I'll go back to the high tide rises all ships. You know, I want to be that person that lifts everybody up and that helps everybody, you know, take that next step and helps, you know, with fair wages and living wages and like making sure that things are changing for the better. And I just, I don't know. I feel like when my roller coaster, you know, goes over that little crest and gets its momentum going, I just only great can come from it. And I'm right there. I'm so close that I'm ready for it to go.
BD, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for sharing your wonderful advice with us and just really getting in depth with me and my audience and sharing all your personal triumphs. And I wish nothing but the best for you.
You're welcome, darling. Thanks for asking me. I really appreciate it.
For those of you listening at home, if you want to contact BD Gunnell, you can contact her through IMDb. She's also on Instagram and Facebook. BD, can you take us out?
This is BD Gunnell, and you are listening to The Quiddatus Factor.
Thank you for listening to The Quiddatus Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbaway. Before I let you go, please check out my website at www.mikearbaway.com. That's MikeArbaue.com. And you can check out my shop. There you'll see a shop called Arbo Artifacts, where I have some t-shirts for sale that will help the show, as well as my wife's Etsy store, which is called Poem Jewelry Design. And Poem actually stands for Power of Each Moment. So please check out that store, because she sells a lot more than jewelry there, and it's really cool and amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I'm her husband. I'm saying it because it's true. And finally, if you can, please become a patron. Thank you for the people who are patrons so far. Thank you so much. And I hope to see everyone join if they can. And please join me every Tuesday for a new episode of The Quiddatus Factor. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiddatus Factor with Michael J. Arbaway. We'll catch you next time.